Do you think I'm doomed too, Varya?
I don't, you know.
Late this afternoon, I got a call from London, and it was Kaplan and Jibitunji and Hildebrand and Catherwood, bless their bones, telling me goodbye. Aunt Helen sent a note, but she is really nearly gaga now since declining rejuve. Your dear letter was in this morning's post. I don't have to tell you how much I appreciate your agreeing to carry on with the liaison committee. It's the one work I really hated to leave unfinished. There is still the ultimate correlation of the pre-rebellion Mazeway material, but I feel that Alicia and Adalberto have that pretty well in hand. And so, I come at last to the farewell, Varya. And I wish I could be eloquent and memorable, instead of just my stodgy self. The gaudiness of the act will have to speak for me. Whatever you do, don't mourn. My only hope of happiness lies on the other side of the exile gate, and I must risk going after it. Remember the years we shared as lovers, and colleagues, and friends, and know that I'm glad they happened. Joy and light to you, my very dear. Forever. Bri. 18. When the last supper with its crazy smorgasbord of requested dishes was finally over, the 8 members of Group Green took their drinks out onto the terrace, where they instinctively gathered apart from the other guests. Even though it was only 20:30, the sky over Lyon had turned black as the scheduled weekly storm built up in the north, pink flashes silhouetted approaching thunderheads.
"Feel the static buildup?" Elizabeth exclaimed. "Even with my metafunctions out, the ionization before a really big storm always gets to me. Every sense sharpens. I begin to feel so clever I can barely contain myself. Capacitor Earth is charging, and so am I. And in just a minute or two I'll be able to zap mountains."
She faced into the strengthening wind, long hair streaming, and red denim jumpsuit clinging to her body. The first subsonics of distant thunder curdled the air. Felice affected a languid tone.
"Were you able to move mountains before?"
"Not really. The larger psychokinetic powers are really very rare among metas, almost as rare as genuine creativity. My PK ability was only good for a few parlor tricks. What I specialized in was far-speaking, the glorified telepathy function. It should really be called far-sensing, because it includes a species of sight as well as hearing. I was also highly operant in redaction, which is the therapeutic and analytical power that most laypersons call mind alteration. My husband had similar faculties. We worked as a team training the minds of very young children in the first difficult steps toward metapsychic unity."
"They wanted me to go to a redactor," Felice said, her voice thrilling with loathing. "I told them I'd rather die. I don't know how you meta people can stand rummaging around in others' brains, or always having some other meta able to read your own secret thoughts. It would be horrible never to be alone, never to be able to hide. I'd go mad."
Elizabeth said gently, "It wasn't like that at all. As far as metas reading each other, there are many different levels to the mind. Modes, we call them. You can far speak to many people on the declamatory mode, or speak at short range to a group on the conversational mode. Then there's the intimate mode that only one person can receive from you. And beneath that are many other conscious and unconscious layers that can be screened off by means of mental techniques that all metaphysics learn when they're very young. We have our private thoughts just as you do. Most of our telepathic communication is nothing more than a kind of voiceless speech and image projection. You can compare it to electronic audiovisuals without the electromagnetic radiation." Felice said, "Deep redactors can get into a person's innermost thoughts."
"True, but with them, there's almost always a doctor-patient relationship appertaining. The patient gives conscious permission for the scrutiny. Even then, a dysfunction may be so strongly programmed that the therapist is powerless to get behind it, no matter how much the patient may be willing to cooperate."
"Yeah," said Stein. He tilted his great mug of beer, holding it before his face.
Felice persisted. "I know that metas can read secret thoughts. Sometimes the coach of our team would bring in redactors to work on guys in slumps. Metas could always spot the ones who'd lost their nerve.
You can't tell me those poor bastards would deliberately let the shrinks find out something that'd get them fired, Elizabeth said.
An untrained person, a non-meta, gives away information in subverbal ways without being aware of it. Think of it as mental mumbling. Haven't you ever stood next to a person who was talking to himself, muttering under his breath? When a person is frightened, or angry, or trying very hard to work out a problem, or even sexually aroused, the thoughts become loud. Even non-metas can sometimes pick up the vibes, the mind pictures, or subvocal speech, or emotional surges. The better the redactor, the better he is at making sense out of the crazy mishmash that human brains broadcast. Brian asked, "Is there any way an ordinary person can shut out a mind reader?" Of course, it's possible to stymie superficial snooping rather easily. Just keep a firm grip on your mental broadcasting. If you think someone is really digging, think of some neutral image like a big black square. Or do some simple exercise when you're not speaking out loud. Count 1, 2, 3, 4 over and over. Or sing some dumb song. That'll block out all but the best redactor.
I'm glad you can't read my mind now, lovey, Aiken Drum put in. You'd fall into a quagmire of sheer funk. I'm so scared about going through this time gate that my red corpuscles have gone puce. I tried to back out. I even told the counselor I'd reform if they'd let me stay here, but nobody believed me. I can't think why, Brian said.
A reddish bolt of lightning reached from cloud to cloud above the hills, but the sound, when it came, was muffled and unsatisfying. A beat from a dead tympanum. Aiken asked Elizabeth,
"How did the ballooning work out, sweets?"
I crammed the theory of building one from native materials, tanning fish skins for the envelope, and weaving a basket and plaiting cordage from bark fibers, but I did my practicing in one of these. She took a package the size of 2 large bricks from her shoulder bag. "It blows up 5 stories tall, double-walled and semi-dirigible, bright red, like my suit. I have a power source to inject hot air. Of course, the power won't last for more than a few flight weeks, so eventually I'll have to shift to charcoal. Making that's a mess, but it's the only ancient fuel that's suitable, unless I can find some coal."
"No sweat, doll eyes," Aiken said. "Stick with me and my mineral maps."
Stein laughed contemptuously.
"And how are you gonna mine this stuff? Draft Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs? The nearest coal's got to be 100 kilometers north, around the Creusot, or Monceau, and way to hell and gone underground. Even if you reach the stuff without blasting, how are you going to tote it around to where it'll do you some good?" "So I'll need a week or two to work out the Fuchin details," Aiken shot back. "There would be other coal deposits, much nearer," Claude Majeski said. "Those modern maps of yours are deceptive, Aiken. They show the strata and deposits as they exist today in the 22nd century, not as they were 6 million years ago. There used to be little limnic coal basins all over the Massif Central and a really large deposit at Saint-Étienne, but they were all worked out late in the 20th century. Go back to the Pliocene and you'll probably find easy pickings just a few kilometers south of here. Find some near a volcano and you might luck out with natural coke.
Better hold off establishing Pliocene Mining Unlimited until you eyeball the territory," Richard advised Aiken with a sour grimace. "The local honchos might have their own ideas about us helping ourselves to the natural resources."
"Entirely possible," Brian agreed.
"We could convince them to let us have a piece of the action," said Felice. She smiled. "In one way or another."
The nun said, "We could also try to avoid conflict by going to an unsettled area."
"I don't think that's Felice's style," Aiken said. "She's looking forward to a little fun and games, aren't you, babe?"
Landry's pale frizzy hair was standing out from her head in a charged cloud. She was wearing the simple chanson again.
"Whatever I'm looking forward to, I'll find. Right now, all I want is another drink. Anybody coming with me?"
She strolled back into the auberge, followed by Stein and Richard.
"Somebody should tell those two they're wasting their time," the old man muttered.
"Poor Felice," Amarie said. "What an ironic name for her, when she's so dreadfully unhappy. That aggressive pose is just another form of armor, like the hockey uniform."
"And underneath she's just crying for love?" Elizabeth inquired, her eyes nearly shut and a faint smile on her lips. "Be careful, sister. That one's standing in the need of prayer, all right, but she's more of a black hole than a black sheep."
"Those eyes eat you alive," Aiken said. "Something damned inhuman is moving around in there."
"Not even normally homophilic," Majeski said. "But I'll certainly grant you the damned."
"That's a cruel and cynical thing to say, Claude," exclaimed the nun. "You don't know anything of the girl's background, any of the things that have maimed her spirit. You talk as though she were some monster, when all she is a pathetic, proud child who has never learned how to love." She took a deep breath. "I'm a medic as well as a nun. One of my vows is to help the suffering. I don't know if I can help Felice, but I'm certainly going to try."
A gust of wind lifted Amory's veil, and she clutched it impatiently with one strong hand.
"Don't stay up too late, guys. Tomorrow's creeping up on us."
She hurried off the terrace and disappeared into the darkened garden.
"Could be. It's the nunny who'll need the prayers," Aiken said, giggling.
"You shut up,"
barked Claude. Then he said, "Sorry, son.
But you want to watch that smart-ass mouth of yours. I'm going to have enough trouble without your adding to it."
He looked at the sky as a prolonged and powerful bolt of lightning descended over the eastern hills. Ground strokes rose up to meet it, and there was a grumble of thunder.
"Here comes the storm. I'm going to bed, too. What I want to know is who the hell ordered the omens for this outfit?"
The old man stomped away, leaving Elizabeth, Aiken, and Brian staring after him. Three successive thunderbolts gave him a ridiculously theatrical exit, but none of the people still on the terrace were smiling anymore.
"I never told you, Aiken," Elizabeth ventured at last, "how much I like your costume. You were right, it's the most spectacular one in the whole auberge."
The little man began snapping his fingers and clacking his heels like a flamenco dancer, turning and posing. Lightning shone on his loose-fitting garment. What seemed to be cloth of gold was actually a costly fabric woven from the viscous threads of Franconian mollusks, famed throughout the galaxy for beauty and toughness. All up and down the arms and legs of the suit were small flapped and fastened pockets. Pockets covered the breast area and the shoulders and hips, and there was a very large pocket on the back with an opening on the bottom. Aiken's golden boots had pockets. His belt had pockets. Even his golden hat, with the brim tipped up jauntily on the right side, had a bandful of tiny pockets. And every pocket, large or small, bulged with some tool or instrument or compressed decimal appliance. Aiken Drum was a walking hardware shop incarnate as a golden idol. "King Arthur would W. Sir Boss at first sight," Elizabeth said, explaining to Brian. "He plans to set himself up as a Pliocene Connecticut Yankee."
"You wouldn't have to bother with Twain solar eclipse to gain attention," the anthropologist conceded. "The suit alone is enough to overawe the peasantry. But isn't it rather conspicuous if you want to spy out the land?" "This big pocket on my back has a chameleon poncho," Brian laughed. "Merlin won't have a prayer."
Aiken watched the Lyon City lights dim and disappear as the approaching storm curtained the valley with rain.
"The Connecticut Yankee had to contend against Merlin in the story, didn't he? Modern technology versus sorcery. Science against the superstition of the Dark Ages. I can't remember too much about the book. Read it when I was about 13 there on Del Riada. And I know I was disappointed with Twain for wasting so much space on half-baked philosophy instead of action. How did it end? You know, I've forgotten. Think I'll go hit the computer for a plaque of the thing for bedtime reading." He gave Brian and Elizabeth a wink. "But I may decide to aim higher than Sir Boss." He slipped off into the auberge. "And then there were two," Brian said. Elizabeth was finishing her Remy Martin. She reminded him, in many ways, of Varya. Calm, incisively intelligent, but with the shutters always closed. She projected cool comradeship and not the slightest jot of sex.
"You won't be staying with Group Green for long, will you, Bri?" she remarked.
The rest of us have built a dependence in these 5 days, but not you.
You don't miss much. Are you sure your metafunctions are really gone?
Not gone, she said, but they might as well be. I've dropped into what we call the latent state because of brain damage. My functions are still there, but inaccessible, walled up in the right half of my brain. Some persons are born latent, with the walls. Others are born operant, as we say, and their mind powers are available to them, especially if they receive proper training from infancy. It's closely analogous to the acquisition of language by babies. My work, back on Denali, involved a good deal of that kind of training. Very rarely, we were even able to coax latents into operancy. But my own case is different. I have just a few teaspoons full of my original cerebrum left. The rest is regenerated. The leavening was enough for a resoul job, and the specialist restored my memories, but for some unknown reason, metaphysic operancy seldom survives a really spectacular brain trauma.
What happened, if you don't mind my asking?
My husband and I were caught in a tornado while we were egging on Denali. It's a sweet little world, with some of the galaxy's worst weather. Lawrence was killed outright. I was broken to bits, but ultimately restored, except for the MP functions.
And is losing them so unbearable? He began, then cursed and apologized.
But she was calm, as always. It's nearly impossible for a non-meta to understand the loss. Think of going deaf, dumb, blind. Think of being paralyzed and numb all over. Think of losing your sex organs, of becoming hideously disfigured. Put all of the anguish together, and it's still not enough. Once you've known the other thing and then lost it... But you've lost something too, haven't you, Bri? Maybe you can understand something of the way I feel.
Lost something? Perhaps it does make more sense to say it that way. God knows there's no logic to the way I feel about Mercy.
Where will you look for her, if the others in the Pliocene don't know where she's gone?
All I have is an instinct. I'll try Armorica first because of her Breton ancestry, and then Albion, the Briton that will be. I'll need the boat because there's a question whether the channel was dry land at the precise period we'll be living in. Sea level seems to have fluctuated in an odd way at the beginning of the Pliocene. But I'll find Mercy somehow. No matter where she's gone.
And what will I find in my beautiful balloon, Elizabeth wondered. And what will it matter? Will the exile world be any less empty than this one?
Perhaps if she and Lawrence had wanted children, but that would have compromised the work, and so they had agreed to forgo them, finding love fulfillment in each other, mating for life as almost all metapsychics did. Knowing that when one had inevitably gone, there would still be the unity, the billion-fold mind embrace of the galactic milieu.
Or there would have been.
The first large drops of rain made a rataplan on the leaves of the plane trees. Blue-white flashes lit the whole valley, and the thunder seemed to shake the mountain roots. Brian grabbed Elizabeth's hand and pulled her through the porte-fenêtre, into the main salon a few seconds before the real downpour began. 19. The pre-dawn was chilly, with gray clouds scudding southward as though late for an appointment at the Mediterranean. The Rhone Valley brimmed with mist. A small log fire had been lit in the main salon, and it was there that the members of Group Green gathered after breakfasting in their rooms. Each person carried the materials for a new life and dressed for the role chosen. Their extra baggage had preceded them to the Timegate staging area, Claude's case of Zebrovna, Brian's scotch, Richard's supplies of spices and yeasts and sodium bisulfate, Stein's keg, Elizabeth's liqueur chocolates, and Amory's large painting of St. Sebastian. Richard and Stein whispered together as they stared at the weak flames. Amory, a half-smile on her lips, fingered the beads of a large wooden rosary that hung from her belt. The others stood apart, waiting. At precisely 500 hours,
Counselor Mishima came down the broad staircase from the mezzanine and bid them a solemn good morning.
"Please, accompany me."
They picked up their things and followed in single file out of the salon, across the terrace, and into the sodden garden, where the flagstones were still puddled with rain, and the blossoms on the rose standards hung torn and battered from the storm. The balconies of the main guest house overlooked the garden. Up above, dim faces behind glass doors were watching them, just as they themselves had watched other dawn processions of 8 time travelers led by a single counselor. They had seen gypsies and Cossacks with desert nomads and vortrekkers, Polynesians with feathered capes and warriors with crossbows, swords, and assegais. There had been Bavarian hikers in lederhosen, bearded white-robed prophets, shaven-headed Oriental votaries, sun-bonneted American pioneers, cowboys, fetishists costumed in pathetic grotesquerie, and sensible-looking people wearing Levi's or tropical gear. The travelers in the early morning parades had moved through the garden to an old cottage shaded by mulberry trees, its white stucco and half-timbering shrouded in climbing vines. Madame Gaudron's lace curtains still hung at the windows, and her pink and white geraniums bloomed in earthenware pots beside the large front door. The 8 guests and the counselor would enter the cottage, and the door would close behind them. After half an hour had elapsed, the counselor alone would emerge. Ryan Grenfell stood behind Counselor Mishima as he unlocked the Guderian cottage with an old-fashioned brass key. A large ginger cat sat in the dry shelter of the shrubbery, watching the group with a sardonic golden eye. Grenfell nodded to it as he passed inside.
"You've seen a lot of us go this way, haven't you, Monsieur Lachat? And how many of them by now felt as used and foolish and tired as I do, but still too stubborn to turn back? Here I go, in my pragmatic tropical kit with a haversack full of simple necessities and high-protein food, armed with a steel-tipped walking stick and a small throwing knife hidden beneath the sleeve of my left forearm, and Mercy's dear picture and dossier in my breast pocket. Here I go, into the deep cellar."
Stein Olsen had to duck his head passing through the door and walk with caution through the hall, lest he brush against Madame's tall clock with its wagging brass pendulum, or knock some fragile bibelot from its place on the wall, or catch the curling horns of his Viking helmet on the little crystal chandelier. Stein was finding it more and more difficult to keep silent. Something was expanding inside of him that demanded to cry out, to roar, to vent a great gust of laughter that would make all the rest of the group shrink away from him, as from the door of a suddenly opened furnace. He felt his manhood coming alive beneath the wolfskin kilt, his feet itching to leap and trample, his arm muscles tensing to swing the battle axe or brandish the vitrador-tipped spear he had added to his armory. Soon, soon, the tangle in his guts would come free. The fire in his blood would power him to heroism, and the joy would be so huge that he would damn near die with the swallowing of it. Richard Voorhees followed Stein carefully down into the cellar. His heavy, folded-over sea boots were awkward on the worn steps. He had a suspicion that he would have to switch to the more comfortable athletic shoes in his backpack once they had passed through the gate and done a first reconnaissance on the other side. Practicalities first, then role-playing. The secret of success, he told himself, would lie in a swift assessment of the local power structure, covert appeal to the have-nots, and establishment of a suitable base. Once he got the distillery operating, with Stein and maybe Landry to keep the locals from muscling in, he'd be on a sound economic footing and ready to jockey for political influence. He smiled in anticipation and carefully adjusted the hip band of the backpack so that it would not wrinkle the skirts of his doublet. Didn't some of those old sea rovers set themselves up as virtual kings in early America? Jean Lafitte, Bloody Morgan, even old Blackbeard himself. And how do you like Richard Voorhees for king of Barataria? He chuckled out loud at the thought, completely forgetting that his costume had not really belonged to an operatic buccaneer, but to a different kind of seafarer altogether.
Felice Landry watched Counselor Mishima manipulate the elaborate lock mechanism of the cellar door. It swung ponderously open, and they entered the old wine keep, dark and musty and with a faint overscent of ozone. She stared at the gazebo, that unlikely gate to freedom, and clutched her new arbalest to her black armored bosom. She was trembling, nauseated, exerting all her willpower to keep from disgracing herself in this ultimate moment. For the first time since early childhood, her eyes, within the T-shaped Grecian helmet opening, were sticky-lashed with tears.
"We will translate you in groups of four, as I have already explained," said Counselor Mishima. "Your extra baggage will follow after an interval of 5 minutes, so be prepared to retrieve it from the Tarfield area. And now, if the first people will position themselves..."
Elizabeth Orme watched without emotion as Brian, Stein, Richard, and Felice crowded closely into the latticed booth and stood motionless. All of them, she thought, have made their plans, except me. They have their goals, touching or comical or mad. But I'll be content to drift through the exile world in my scarlet balloon, looking down on all the people and the animals, listening to wind and the cry of birds, smelling pollen, resin from the forest, smoke from wildfire on the grassland. I'll come to Earth only when I feel that the Earth is real again, and I am, if we ever can be. Mirrored walls sprang up as Mishima threw the switch. The four people in the gazebo were on their way. Aiken Drum, his golden suit glittering with 100 reflections from the cellar lights, stepped forward impulsively.
"Damn! So that's all there is to it? Not even enough power drained to dim the lamps?"
He studied the vine-like cables that seemed to grow out of the packed soil of the floor and disappear somewhere short of the vaulted ceiling. Mishima warned him to touch nothing, and Aiken gave him a reassuring gesture. But he had to get a close look. The glassy framework was shot through with faintly moving patterns hovering at the edge of visibility. The black bodies of the lattice nodes each enclosed a tiny point of unwinking light that seemed to be shining at a great distance.
"How long does it take for people to get from here to there?" Aiken asked. "Or should I say, from now till then?"
"The translation is, in theory, instantaneous," replied Mishima. "We maintain the field for some minutes in order to enable a safe exit, and I may say that never once in the 4 years that the human polity has carried on the work of Madame Gudrion has there been an accident to time travelers," Aiken said.
"Counselor, I'd like to take one more thing with me into exile. Can you give me a description and diagram of this device?"
Without a word, Mishima opened the oaken cabinet and took out a small plaque book. It was obvious that other travelers had made the same request. Aiken kissed the plaque triumphantly and stowed it in a large pocket below the right knee of his shining suit. Mishima stepped to the control console and switched off the field. The mirror walls winked out. The gazebo was empty.
"They have passed safely through the portal. Now the rest of you may enter."
Claude Majewski hefted his 20-kilo pack and was the first inside.
"Old man, you're crazy," he said to himself, then smiled because he could hear Jen saying it.
On a sudden impulse, he opened the pack compartment that held the carved and inlaid box from the Polish mountains and took it out.
"Is there really a Pliocene world beyond this gate, black girl? Or is it a hoax after all? And do we step out of the glass cage into death? Oh, Jen, go with me, wherever."
Sister Anna Marie Roccaro was the last to get into position, smiling an apology as she crowded next to Aiken Drum and felt the hard tools in his pockets pressing through the sleeves and skirts of her habit. Aiken was nearly a head shorter than the sturdy nun, almost as small as Felice, but in no way as vulnerable. He'd survive with Aiken Drum.
"May the rest of us as well. And now, Mother of God, hear my archaic prayer. Salve Regina, Mater Misericordiae, Vita Dulcedo,
et spes nostro salve, et te clamamus exules, filii havi. Ad te suspiramus, gementes et flentes in hac lacrimarum vale. Eia ergo advocata nostra, illos tuos misericordes oculos ad nos converte, et Jesum, benedictum fructum ventris tui, nobis post hac exilium ostende.
Mishima threw the switch.
There was pain of translation, and a momentous snap, hurtling them into the gray limbo. They hung without breath or heartbeat, each one screaming alone into silence. And then they felt sudden warmth, and opened their eyes to a blinding dazzle of green and blue. Hands were pulling them, voices urging them to step forward out of the shimmering area that had been the gazebo, to step down a little, to come out quickly, before the field reversed itself, to enter into exile.
Part 2. The Initiation. 1.
Come along, sport, come along now, step down a little. We're the guardians of the time portal, we're here to help you. Come on. You're feeling zonked out right now, but that'll pass away right quick. Just relax and come along. You made it safe to exile. You're safe. You hear me? Come on now. We're all going along to Castle Gateway. You can relax there. We'll have a nice yabber and answer all your questions. Come on.
As the pain receded and his wits phased in again, Brian was at first aware only of the nagging voice and brilliant light. Such an ordinary, twangy voice. Such an extraordinary light. He was conscious of somebody holding him by the right wrist and upper arm, a blurred figure he couldn't quite focus on. Another someone seemed to be vacuuming dust off his clothes with a handheld machine. Then he was being forced to walk, and he looked at his feet and saw them quite clearly, shod in a pair of pigskin boots with crinkled soles, moving first over damp granite, then on thick sod with grass that had been mowed or cropped short. He was stepping on small daisy-like flowers. A butterfly with zebra stripes and long swallowtails hung motionless on a dew-spangled weed.
"Wait," he mumbled. "Stop."
The insistent tugging left off, and he was able to stand still and look about him. The newly risen sun shone over a wide expanse of green tableland, going golden in its higher, drier reaches. Tanzania? Nebraska? Durabège? France? Nearer, there were rounded boulders of crystalline rock. They had been used to mark the sides of a path that led back to a peculiar, indistinct block, hanging in the air like a heat mirage. Men dressed alike in white tunics and pants with blue cords about the waist were gathered around Richard and Stein and Felice. Several more guardians stood waiting for the other members of Group Green to arrive. The wavering force field winked out. Brian insisted upon standing still until it reappeared with four more human figures, which the guardians hastened to lead into open ground.
"All safe, sport. You can come along with me now. The rest will all be tagging along."
Brian discovered that the ordinary voice belonged to a skinny, deeply tanned man with grayish-blonde hair and a long nose bent to one side. He had a prominent larynx and wore a twisted necklet of dark metal, about as thick and as round as a finger, incised with intricate little markings and fastened in the front with a knob-like catch. His tunic, apparently of finely spun wool, had a streak of dried food down the front. For some reason, this reassured Brian. He did not resist when the man began pulling him along the path again. They were ascending a small hill a couple of hundred meters from the time portal area. As the anthropologist's mind cleared, he was excited to see a stone fortress of considerable size perched on the eminence facing east. It did not resemble the fairy tale chateau of France, but rather the simpler castles of his English homeland. Except for the absence of a moat, it was something like Bodiam in Sussex. When they came closer, Brian saw that there was an outer ring wall of rough masonry about twice the height of a man. Inside this, beyond an encircling space that formed an outer ward, was a four-sided bailey, a hollow square without a central keep, with towers at the corners, and a great barbican at the entrance. Above the gate was the effigy of a bearded human face, crafted in yellow metal. When they came close to the outer wall, Brian heard an eerie howling.
"Right through here, cub," said the guide reassuringly. "Don't pay no mind to the amphibians."
They went into a passage that led through the outer ward to the portcullis of the barbican. On either side were stout wooden grills. A dozen huge creatures galloped clumsily up to the bars and began slavering and snarling.
"Interesting watchdogs," Brian said unsteadily. The guide kept hustling him along.
"Too right. Primitive canids, bear dogs, we call them. They weigh about 300 kilos and eat anything that bloody well doesn't eat them first. When we have to secure the fortress, we just lift these grills and give the beasts access to the whole outer ward."
Inside the large barbican structure was a corridor that branched right and left, leading to peripheral rooms behind the massive curtain wall. The guide led Brian up an open stairway to the second level. Here the corridors were whitewashed, and there were handsome brass sconces with containers of oil ready to be lighted at nightfall. Deeply bayed windows, giving onto the inner court, let daylight into the hall.
"We've got a small reception room for each of you," the guardian said. "Sit down and rest and have some tucker if you like."
He threw open a heavy wooden door and led the way into a chamber that measured about 4x4. It was carpeted with a thick wool rug in shades of brown and gray, and furnished with surprisingly well-crafted chairs and benches of turned wood. Some had corded seats and backs, while others were padded with black woolen cushions. On a low table were ceramic pitchers containing hot and cold liquids, drinking tumblers, a bowl of purple plums and small cherries, and a plateful of seed cakes. The guide helped Brian unfasten his backpack.
"There's facilities through that curtained door. Some new arrivals feel the need. A chap from the interview committee will come to you in about 10 minutes. Meanwhile, just live it cool."
He went out and closed the door. Brian walked to an embrasured window in the exterior wall and gazed at the landscape through an ornamental brass grating. He could see amphibians prowling in the narrow space below. Beyond the outer wall was the pathway and the rock outcropping with its four cornerstones that marked the position of the time portal. Shading his eyes against the rising sun, he saw the savanna undulating gently toward the Rhone Valley. A small herd of four-footed animals grazed in the far distance. A bird sang an intricate song. Somewhere in the castle, the sound of human laughter echoed briefly. Brian Grenfell sighed. So this was the Pliocene. He began examining his surroundings, his mind automatically filing away the homely details that could tell an anthropologist so much about the culture of a new world. Walls of mortared stone, whitewashed, caissine, with stained oak framing around the doorways and shutters for the glassless window. The convenience had a smaller louvered slit in the wall for ventilation. Its toilet was a simple hole in the masonry, reminiscent of the medieval garter robes to be found in English castles. It sported a wooden seat and a nicely carved lid, and had a box of green leaves mounted on the wall beside it. For wash-up, there was a ceramic basin and laver, thrown stoneware, slip-decorated, salt-glazed. The soap was fine-grained, properly aged, and scented with some herb. The hand towel resembled coarse linen. He strolled back to the reception room. The food laid out on the table added its data to the mass. Brian ate a cherry, putting the large pit neatly into an empty dish, and noting that the flesh was meager but sweet, probably the original European bird cherry or some close relative. The tiny plums also seemed to be wild. If any time travelers had brought budwood from improved stone fruits, the resulting trees might have been too susceptible to Pliocene insects and diseases to survive without chemical protection. He wondered about wine grapes and strawberries, but seemed to recall that both were rather resistant, and so there was a fair chance that Richard would have his wine, and Mercy her strawberries and cream. The cold drink tasted of citrus, and the steaming pitcher turned out to contain hot coffee. Agnostic though he was, Brian sent up a prayer of thanks for the latter. The seed cakes had a firm texture and a faint aroma of honey. They had been baked properly and decorated with hazelnuts on top. The cookie plate was incised with a simple motif and had a handsome sang de boeuf glaze. There was a light tapping on the door. The brass latch lifted to admit a mild-looking older man with a neatly trimmed mustache and imperial. He smiled tentatively and sidled in when Brian gave him a friendly murmur. He wore a blue tunic with a white cord about the waist and had the same necklet of dark metal as the guardians had worn. He seemed ill at ease and perched on the very edge of a bench.
"My name is Tully. I'm a member of the interview committee. If you wouldn't mind, I mean, we can probably help you find your way about and all if you'd tell us just a little about yourself and your plans. Not to pry, you understand, but if we could know just a little of your background and about the trade you've learned, it would help ever so much. I mean, we could tell you which places have need of your talents if you're interested in settling down. And if you don't want to settle down, perhaps you have questions you'd like to ask me. I'm here to help you, do you see?"
"He's afraid of me," Brian realized in amazement. And then he thought of the kind of persons who might come through the gate, persons such as Stein and Felice, for example, who might react to the initial disorientation and culture shock with violence, and decided that Tully had every reason to be cautious in his initial encounter with new arrivals. He probably rated combat pay. To soothe the man, Brian leaned back easily in one of the chairs and munched on a seed cake.
"These are very good. Made with oats, are they? And sesame? It's reassuring to be greeted with civilized food. An excellent psychological maneuver on your part." Tully gave a delighted little laugh.
"Oh, do you think so? We've tried hard to make Castle Gateway a welcoming environment, but some of the arrivals are deeply stressed, and we sometimes have difficulty calming them. I felt a bit wonky at first, but I'm fine now. Don't look so anxious, man. I'm harmless. And I'll answer any reasonable questions."
"Splendid."
The interviewer smiled his relief. He took out a small sheet of writing material, paper, vellum, from a belt pouch together with an ordinary 22nd century pen.
"Your name and former occupation?"
"Brian Grenfell. I was a cultural anthropologist, specializing in the analysis of certain kinds of social conflict. I'm most interested in studying your society here, even though I'm not too sanguine about the possibility of publishing my work."
Tully chuckled in appreciation.
"Fascinating, Brian. You know, there have been very few members of your profession to come through the gate. You'll certainly want to go on to the Capitol and talk to the people there. They'd be most interested in you. You could provide unique insights."
Brian looked surprised.
"I'm equipped to earn my living as a fisherman or coastal trader. I never thought my academic credentials would be appreciated in the Pliocene." "But we aren't savages," Tully protested. "Your scientific talents will very likely prove invaluable to, administrative persons who'll welcome your advice."
"So you do have a structured society?"
"Very simple, very simple," the man said hurriedly, "but I'm sure you'll find it worthy of careful study."
"I've already begun on that, you know,"
Brian watched Tully's meticulously barbered face.
"This building, for instance, has been well designed for security. I'm most interested in knowing what you secure against." "Oh, there are several kinds of animals that are quite dangerous. The giant hyenas, the Machairodus saber cats."
"But this castle seems more suited to defense against human aggression."
The interviewer fingered his neck ring. His eyes darted here and there, and finally fixed Brian with a sincere expression.
"Well, of course there are unstable personalities coming through the portal,
And even though we try very hard to assimilate everyone, we have an inevitable problem with the really serious misfits. But you need have no fear, Brian, because you and the rest of your party are quite safe here with us. Actually, the, disturbed element tends to hide away in the mountains and in other remote places. Please, don't worry. You'll find that the high culture persons have complete ascendancy here in exile. Everyday life is as tranquil as it can be in a, aboriginal environment. How nice of you. Tully nibbled on the end of his pen. For our records, that is, it would be helpful if we knew just exactly what kind of equipment you've brought with you. To be put into the common store? Tully was shocked.
Oh, nothing like that, I assure you.
All travelers must retain the tools of their trade in order to survive and be useful members of society, mustn't they? If you'd rather not discuss the matter, I won't press, but sometimes people come through with extraordinary books or plants or other things that could be of great benefit to everyone, and if these persons would consent to share, the quality of life for all would be enhanced. He smiled winningly and poised the pen.
Aside from a trimaran sailing craft and the fishing gear, I have nothing special. A voice writer with a plaque converter for the sheets, a rather large library of books and music, a case of scotch that seems to have gone astray.
And your traveling companions? Brian said easily.
I think you'd better let them speak for themselves.
Oh, certainly. I only thought I'd... Well, yes. Tully put away his writing materials and flashed another bright smile.
Now then, you must have some questions you would like to ask me.
Just a few, for now. What is your total population?
Well, we hardly keep accurate census figures, you understand, but I think a reasonable estimate would be about 50,000 human souls.
Strange. I would have guessed more. Do you suffer from disease?
No, hardly at all. Our ordinary macro-immunization and genetically engineered resistances seem to protect us very well here in the Pliocene.
Although the very earliest travelers didn't enjoy the full-spectrum coverage of those who have come to exile within the last 30 years or so, and of course those who were lately rejuvenated can expect a much longer lifespan than those who were treated with the earlier technology, but most of our, attrition has come from accidents.
He nodded soberly.
We have physicians, of course, and certain medications are regularly sent through the time portal, but we cannot regenerate persons suffering really serious trauma. And this world may be said to be civilized, but it's hardly tame, if you take my meaning.
I understand. Just one other question for now. Grenfell reached into his breast pocket and took out the color picture of Mercedes Lamballe. Can you tell me where I might find this woman? She arrived here in mid-June of this year.
The interviewer took the picture and studied it with widening eyes. He finally said,
I think you will find she has gone to our capital city in the south. I remember her very well. She made a most vivid impression on all of us. In view of her unusual talents, she was invited to, go down and assist with administration.
Brian frowned.
What unusual talents?
In some haste, Tully said.
Our society is quite different from that of the galactic milieu, Brian. Our needs are special. All of this will be made clear to you later when you get a more complete overview from people in the capital. From a professional standpoint, you have some intriguing investigations awaiting you.
Tully rose.
Have a little more refreshment now. Another person would like to interview you in a short while, and then you can rejoin your companions. I'll come for you in about half an hour, shall I?
Smiling again, he slipped out the door. Brian waited for a few moments, then got up and tried the latch. It wouldn't budge. He was locked in. He looked around the room for his iron-shod walking stick. It was nowhere to be found. He rolled up his sleeve to check on the little throwing knife in its scabbard. He was not surprised to find that the leather sheath was empty. Had his introductory vacuum cleaning been a frisk with a metal detector? Well, well, he said to himself. So this is the Pliocene. He sat down again to wait. 2. Richard Voorhees had recognized the psychic disorientation of the time portal as a variant of that experienced by humans every time that starships passed from the normal universe into the quasi-dimensional gray subspace during superluminal travel. However, the snap of temporal translation was prolonged many times longer than that of hyperspace crossover. Richard had also noted peculiar differences in the texture of the gray limbo. There was a dimly perceived rotation about consecutive axes. A compression. Was everything, every atom in the universe, subtly smaller 6 million years in the past? A quality to the gray that was less fluid and more frangible. Did one swim through space and smash through time? A sense of diminishing life force all about him that would fit in nicely with certain philosophers' notions of the essence of the milieu. When Richard dropped through the air a short distance and landed on the granite outcropping of Exile, he was in control of himself almost immediately, as every starship's master had to be after spatial translation. Pushing aside the eager hands of a guardian, he exited from the Tau field under his own power and did a fast eyeball scan while the guide murmured inanities. Just as Counselor Mishima had promised, the Pliocene Rhone Valley was much more narrow, and the country on this western flank, where the Auberge would one day stand on a wooded hillside, was now flatter and less dissected by streams. It was, in fact, a plateau, rising slightly to the south. He spotted the castle. On the skyline behind it, smoking in the early sunlight, were two titanic snow-clad volcanoes. The northerly one would be Mont Dore, the larger cone to the south, the Cantal. There was grass. There were rabbity critters crouching motionless, pretending to be rocks. Off in a hollow was a grove of trees. Did the little ape-like ramapithecines roam these woods? Guardians were leading Brian, Stein, and Felice up the path toward the castle. Other men in white helped the second group from the time gate area. Who was in charge of the place? Some Pliocene baron? Was there an aristocracy here? Would he, Richard, be able to elbow his way into it? His mind tossed up question after question, fizzing with a youthful enthusiasm that astounded and delighted him. He recognized what was happening. It was a belated reprise of the spacer's favorite malady, the new planetfall eagers. Anyone who ranged widely throughout the galaxy and endured the boredom of subspace gray was likely, if not too jaded, to work himself into a lather over anticipation over the imminent landing upon a hitherto unvisited world. Would the air smell good? Would the ions vitalize or poop? Would the vegetation and animals delight or disgust the eye? Would the local food ditto the taste buds? Would the people be successful and sprightly or beaten down by hardship? Would the ladies screw if you asked them to? He whistled a few notes of the bawdy old ballad through his teeth. Only then did he become aware of the anxious voice and the plucking at his sleeve.
Come along, sir. Your friends have gone on to Castle Gateway. We've got to get along, too. You want to rest and refresh yourself and, like as not, ask some questions.
The guardian was a dark-haired man, well-built but rather raw-boned, with the spurious youthfulness and overwise eyes of a fairly recent rejuvenate. Richard took in the dark metal necklet of the white tunic that was probably a lot more comfortable in this tropical climate than Richard's own black velvet and heavy broadcloth.
"Just let me look around a little, guy," Richard said, but the man kept tugging at him. To avoid argument, Richard began to move along the path leading to the castle.
"That's a nice commanding position you've got there, guy. Is that mound artificial? What do you do for a water supply up here? How far to the nearest town?"
"Easy on, traveler. Just you come along with me. The interview committee men will be able to answer your questions better than I can."
"Well, at least tell me the prospects for local gash. I mean, back in the present, or the future, or whatever the hell you call it here, We were told that the male-female ratio here was about 4-1. I want to tell you, that almost turned me off from coming over. If it wasn't for certain pressing circumstances, I might not have come to Exile at all, so how is it, really? You have women up at the castle?
The man replied austerely.
We're hosting a number of female travelers, and the Lady Apone is temporarily in residence. No women live permanently at Castle Gateway.
So where do you guys get it? Is there a village or a town for weekend passes or whatever?
In a matter-of-fact manner, the man said,
many of the castle staff are homophile or autoerotic. The rest are serviced by traveling entertainers from Renaya or Bursak. There are no small villages in this area, only widely separated cities and plantations. Those of us who serve at the castle are happy to remain there. We're well rewarded for our work.
He fingered his necklet with a small smile, then redoubled his effort to rush the new arrival along.
Sounds like a real organized setup, said Richard in a dubious tone.
You've come into a wonderful world. You're going to be very happy here once you've learned a little about our ways. Don't mind the bear dogs. We keep them for security. They can't get at us.
They hurried through the outer ward and into the barbican, where the guardian tried to steer Richard up the stairway. But the ex-spacer pulled away, saying,
be right back. Gotta take a look at this fascinating place.
But you can't, exclaimed the guardian.
But he did. Clutching his plumed hat, Richard broke into a run that was only slightly slowed by the weight of his backpack. He went clattering over the flagstones into the deep interior of the gatehouse, dodging around corners at random until he emerged into the large inner courtyard of the castle. This early in the morning, the area was deeply shadowed, surrounded on four sides by the two-story hollow wall with its corner towers and battlements. The courtyard was nearly 80 meters square. At its center was a fountain with trees planted around it in stone boxes. More trees grew at regular intervals around the perimeter. One entire side of the yard was taken up by a large double corral, neatly walled in perforated stone. Half of it contained several score large quadruped animals of a type Richard had never seen before. The other half of the corral seemed to be empty. Hearing the voices of pursuers, Richard dodged into a kind of cloister that ran around the other three sides of the inner ward. He ran for a short distance, then turned into a side corridor. It was a dead end. But on either side were doors leading into apartments within the great hollow wall. He opened the first right-hand door, slipped inside, and closed the door behind him. The room was black. He stood perfectly still, catching his breath, gratified to hear the sound of running feet grow louder, then fade away. For the moment, he had escaped. He fumbled in one pocket of his backpack for a light. Before he could switch it on, he heard a faint sound. He stood immobile. A line of radiance had sprung into being across the darkened room. Someone was opening another door with infinite slowness, and the illumination from the inner chamber swept toward him in a widening beam until he was caught. Silhouetted in the doorway was a very tall woman. She was dressed in a filmy sleeveless gown that seemed almost invisible. Richard could not see her face, but he knew she had to be beautiful. Lady Apone, he said, not knowing why.
You may come in. He had never heard such a voice. Its musical sweetness held an unmistakable promise that set him on fire. He dropped his pack and came toward her, a figure dressed entirely in black, drawn by her bright allure. As she went slowly into the inner chamber, he followed. Dozens of lamps hung from the ceiling, reflecting off draperies of shimmering gold and white gauze that curtained a vast bed. The woman held out her arms. Her loose gown was of pale blue, unbelted, with long yellow panels floating from the shoulders like misty wings. She wore a golden circlet about her neck, and a golden diadem on her blonde hair.
The hair hung nearly to her waist, and so, if Richard's eyes didn't deceive him, did her incredibly pendulous breasts beneath the gossamer fabric. She stood nearly half a meter taller than he did. Looking down with unhuman glowing eyes, she said, "Come closer." He felt the room turn, and the eyes shone more brilliantly, and soft skin caressed him, until he was drawn into an abyss of joy so intense that it must destroy him. She cried, "Can you? Can you?" He tried, and he could not. The sweet breath of light turned into a whirlwind then, screeching and cursing and tearing at him, not at his body, but at something cringing apologetically behind his eyes, worthless and deserving to be punished. Torn out, held up to ridicule, flung down and trodden upon, hammered by blasts of hatred, the shapeless thing shrank into a smaller and smaller mass until it was a blot of utter insignificance, finally vanishing in the white blaze of pain. Richard woke. A man in a blue tunic knelt at his feet, fumbling with his ankles. Richard was clamped into a heavy chair seated in a small room with walls of unadorned gray limestone blocks. The Lady Epone was standing in front of him, her eyes flat and jade-colored, her mouth curved up in a smile of contempt.
"He's ready, lady."
"Thank you, Jean-Paul. The headpiece, if you will." The man brought a simple silver coronet with 5 points and placed it on Richard's head. Epone turned to a construction on a table beside the chair, which Richard had mistaken for some kind of elaborate, jeweled metallic sculpture. The apparatus glowed faintly in its crystalline parts, the multicolored lights waxing and waning in what was evidently some malfunction. Epone gave the largest prism, a pinkish thing the size of a fist, an impatient flick with thumb and forefinger. "Ah, bah! Will nothing function in this cursed place? There. Now we will begin." She folded her arms and inclined her gaze on Richard. "What is your given name?"
"Go to hell," he muttered.
A tremendous throb of agony seemed to lift the top of his skull. "Please speak only to answer my questions. Obey my orders at once. Do you understand?" Sagging against the chair clamps, he whispered,
"Yes."
"What is your given name?"
"Richard."
"Close your eyes, Richard. Without speaking, I wish you to send out the word, help."
"Sweet Jesus, that was an easy one. Help."
A man's voice said,
-6, far speak."
"Open your eyes, Richard," commanded Epone. "Now I want you to listen carefully. Here is a dagger." She drew a silver blade from somewhere within her draperies and held it toward him on both open hands. The palms had only a few faint lines in their milky softness. "Force me to plunge the dagger into my heart, Richard. Revenge yourself on me. Destroy me by my own hand. Kill me, Richard." He tried. He willed the death of the monstrous bitch. He tried.
-2.5 coerce, said the minion, standing behind the chair.
Epone said, "Concentrate on what I am saying to you, Richard. Your life and your future here in exile depend on what you do in this room." She cast the dagger down onto the table, less than a meter away from his pinioned right arm. "Make the knife rise up, Richard. Send it at me. Drive it into my eyes. Do it, Richard." There was a terrible eagerness in her tone this time, and he tried desperately to oblige her. He knew now what was happening. They were testing him for latent metafunctions, this one psychokinesis, but he could have told them.
-7 PK.
She leaned close to him.
fragrant, lovely. Burn me, Richard. Bring up flames from your mind, and let them blacken and cook and turn to ash this body that you will never know, because you are not a man, but a poor worm without sex or sensibility. Burn me. But he was the one who burned. Tears coursed down his cheeks and caught in his mustache. He tried to spit at her, but his mouth was clotted and his tongue swollen. He twisted his head because his eyes would not close to shut out the blue and primrose coolness of her cruelty.
+2.5 create.
Interesting. But not good enough, of course. Rest for a moment now, Richard. Think of your companions upstairs. One by one they will come to this room as so many others have come, and I will get to know them as I know you.
And some will serve the Tanu in this way and others in that, but all will serve.
Save a few blessed ones, who will find that the gate into exile is the door into paradise after all. You have one last chance. Come into my mind. Feel me. Probe me. Take me to bits and reassemble me in a more compliant image. She bent closer and closer toward him, until the flawless skin of her face was only a few hands' breadth from his own. No pores, no creases on that face. Only pinpoint pupils and the nephrite eyes. But beauty. Vile and tantalizing beauty of incredible age. Richard strained against the clamps of the chair. His mind screamed. I hate you, and violate you, and diminish you, and cover you with excrement. And I call you dead. I call you rotted. I call you writhing in pain everlasting, stretched on the rack of the superficies until the exhalation of the universe dies and space falls in upon itself.
-1, redact.
Richard fell forward. The coronet dropped from his head to strike the stone flags with a bell tone of finality.
You failed again, Richard. Epone said in a bored voice. Inventory his possessions, Jean-Paul, then put him in with the others for the northern caravan to Fania.
3. Elizabeth Orme was so dazed by the shock of the translation that she scarcely felt the guiding hands that urged her up the pathway toward the castle. Someone relieved her of her pack, and she was glad. The soothing mumble of the guide's voice carried her back to another time of pain and fear long ago. She had felt herself awakening in the cushioning womb of warm solution, where she had been regenerating for 9 months in a web of tubes and wires and monitoring devices, her eyes blinded, her skin deprived of tactile sensation by the long immersion in amniotic fluid. She could nevertheless hear a gentle human voice that calmed her fear, told her she was whole again and shortly to be freed.
Lawrence, she whimpered, are you all right?
Come along now, Missy, just come along. You're safe now and you're among friends. We're all going up to Castle Gateway and you'll be able to relax there. Just keep on walking like a good girl.
Strange howls of maddened animals. Open the eyes in horror and shut them again. Where is this place?
Castle Gateway, in the world you call exile. Take it easy, Missy. The amphicians can't get us. Just up these stairs now and we'll have you lying down for a nice rest. Here we go.
Opening doors and a small room with... what? Hands were pressing her to sit down, to lie down. Someone lifted her feet and arranged a pillow under her head.
Don't go away. Don't leave me here alone.
I'll be back in just a few minutes with the healer, Missy. We won't let anything happen to you. Bank on that. You're a very special lady. Relax now while I get somebody to help you. Washroom behind that curtain.
When the door closed, she lay motionless until a surge of nausea rose in her gorge. Struggling up, she lurched into the washroom and vomited into the basin. An excruciating pain lanced her brain, and she nearly collapsed. Leaning against the whitened stone wall, she gasped for breath. The nausea receded, and so, more slowly, did the agony in her head. She became aware of someone else entering the room. Two persons speaking, arms supporting her, the rim of a thick cup pressed to her lips.
"I don't want anything."
"Drink this, Elizabeth. It will help you."
"Open, swallow. There. Good. Now sit again." A voice, deep and honey-rich.
"Thank you, Costa. I'll take care of her now. You may leave us."
"Yes, Lord."
Sound of door closing. Elizabeth clutched the arms of her chair, waiting for the pain to come back. When it didn't, she let herself relax and slowly opened her eyes. She was sitting at a low table that held a few dishes of food and drink. Across from her, standing beside a high window, was an extraordinary man. He was robed in white and scarlet, and wore a heavy belt of linked squares of gold set with red and milk-white gemstones. Around his neck was a golden torque, thick, twisted strands with an ornamented catch in front. His fingers, holding a stoneware cup with the medicine, were oddly long, with prominent joints. She wondered vaguely how he had managed to slip on the many rings that gleamed in the morning sunlight. The man had blonde, shoulder-length hair, cut in a fringe above his eyes, which were very pale blue, seemingly without pupils, and sunken deep into bony orbits. His face was beautiful, despite the fine webwork of lines at the corners of his smiling mouth. He was nearly 2.5 meters tall.
"Oh, God! Who are you? What is this place? I thought I was going back in time to Pliocene Earth. But this is not... This can't be..."